President Carter today accepted the resignation of his Secretary of State. Cyrus Vance submitted it a week ago, 4 days before the attempted rescue of the hostages in Iran, a mission he opposed. The president says that because of his opposition, Vance made the right decision to step down. He's replaced by his deputy, Warren Christopher, at least for a while. Cyrus Vance was regarded in Congress as one of the administration's most respected officials, and his resignation was greeted on Capitol Hill today with widespread regret. But Florida Democratic Senator Richard Stone thinks Vance was disturbed with more than just the rescue attempt.
Well, I think that Cy Vance shouldered the lion's share of the blame for the mistaken United Nations vote last month, and most probably didn't feel it warranted or justified that he would have to shoulder the lion's share of explaining the failure of the rescue mission in Iran, which he opposed.
Senator Henry Jackson of Washington State says Vance could not have quit at a worse time, that it throws more confusion into America's already confused foreign policy. The bodies of the 8 soldiers killed in Iran have been removed from that gruesome display outside the American embassy. What happens next is unclear. President Bonnie Sauter says the bodies will be handed over to representatives of the Vatican, Red Cross, and Swiss government. More from Nick Cummingbruce in Tehran.
Mr. Bonnie Sauter implicitly reaffirmed that there would be no conditions placed on the return of the bodies, quashing a suggestion from some of his right-wing political rivals that the bodies should be kept here in order to bargain for concessions from the U.S. Mr. Bonnie Sauter went on to make it clear that Iran is planning a propaganda campaign against the United States over the abortive rescue mission, aimed particularly at the EEC countries and Japan, which will be invited to send delegations to Iran to see what were described as the signs of aggression. The student holding the hostages reported today that some who had supposedly been sent to the northwestern city of Tabriz were being accommodated in the former American consulate there. There is still no independent confirmation of the hostages' whereabouts. Nick Cummingbruce for National Public Radio, Tehran.
A series of explosions rocked Tehran today. At least 3 people were killed, many others injured. In Paris, Iranian dissidents said a group calling for the overthrow of Ayatollah Khomeini claimed responsibility for one of the bombings. For the first time in 6 months, President Carter is outside Washington and Camp David. In his first trip since the American embassy was taken, the president flew to Texas and met with the 5 soldiers injured in the rescue attempt in Iran. The president was somber. He made no statement when he landed in San Antonio. He immediately went to Wilfred Hall Medical Center to visit one soldier and then to the burn center at Brooke Army Medical Center to see the 4 most seriously injured men. Carter went from room to room chatting with each soldier. The president flies back to Washington tonight. He'll hold a news conference tomorrow evening at 9 Eastern Time. In Luxembourg, diplomats attending the summit of European Community Nations today reaffirm their support of President Carter. They promise to go through with sanctions against Iran on May 17th unless decisive progress is made toward freeing the American hostages. The 9 allied leaders shied away from public criticism of last week's aborted commando raid in Iran, but privately the Europeans didn't conceal their feelings of being misled by the Carter administration. The rescue attempt came just 3 days after the EEC agreed to economic sanctions against Iran in hopes of forestalling U.S. military action. 7-foot seas and 20-knot winds in the Florida Straits today didn't deter the sea lift of refugees from Cuba to southern Florida. Things did get so tough, though, at one point that the already disorganized program was stopped for a while. Exile leaders say dozens of boats have been wrecked by the weekend storms, but no casualties are reported. The influx of refugees is putting pressure on the city of Miami, which has no place to put all the exiles right now. A report from Joe Maglino.
Yesterday, Miami's Mayor Maurice Ferre asked Florida Governor Bob Graham to declare the city a disaster area in order to get money from state government to assist in the processing and sheltering of the refugees. There are 3 centers set up here to house Cubans coming to Florida without families. One, a boxing arena, was open last night. The stream of boats coming from Cuba's port of Mariel slowed this weekend, and officials have been able to catch up with the processing of the refugees. But it's reported that clearing weather will bring 1,000 boats to Key West in the next several days. This is Joe Maglino in Miami.
It was the finale after a weekend of anti-nuclear demonstrations here in Washington. About 1,000 people today staged what they called a funeral procession between the Energy Department and the Pentagon. They tried to block doors at the Defense Department. Protest organizers say they wanted to be arrested. The police complied. About 200 were, including peace activist Daniel Ellsberg. On Wall Street today, prices were mixed at the close of trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up nearly 2 points, ending the day at 805.46. Trading was moderate. The average price of a common share gained 14 cents. I'm Richard Harris in Washington.
Secretary of State Cyrus Vance resigned today in protest over the attempted rescue of the American hostages in Iran. Word of the resignation leaked out late last night, but it was not until today in the State Department's press briefing room that Mr. Vance made his decision public. NPR's Bill Buesenberg was there.
Vance walks into the briefing room right on time, but today he walks with a slight limp caused by gout. He looks tired peering over his reading glasses, but he's smiling. Uncharacteristically, reporters applaud the man whose resignation they have come to hear.
Good morning.
They already know the gist of what he will say because of leaks and Xerox copies of an exchange of handwritten letters between the president and the secretary. Vance wrote the president that he resigned with a heavy heart, but it was an untenable situation for him to continue. The president replied he was accepting the resignation with regret, but the secretary had made the correct decision. Vance sums up what he wants to tell the public in just one paragraph.
As you know, I could not support the difficult decision taken by the president on the rescue operation in Iran. I therefore submitted my resignation to the president last week. I have told the president that I continue to support fully his policies on other foreign policy issues. I have assured him that he can count on my support for his continued leadership of our nation. He will always have my deepest respect and affection.
No administration official will say exactly when the secretary began thinking about leaving, but it was at least 3 weeks ago. On Thursday, April 10th, Vance left for a long-planned vacation to Florida with his wife. The next day, April 11th, with Vance gone, the National Security Council met and gave the go-ahead for the ill-fated rescue mission. Vance knew about plans for the mission, but it's unclear if he knew that the NSC would meet while he was gone. His deputy, Warren Christopher, was at the meeting. Vance returned to Washington on Monday, April 14th. He was immediately presented with the NSC approval of something he had consistently opposed. The next day, April 15th, Vance presented his arguments in opposition to the operation to the president privately and then to the full National Security Council. The decision to go ahead was never changed. The president then knew his approval of the rescue mission would cost him a Secretary of State. Aides say the Secretary of State spent the next 5 days in communion with himself. On Monday, April 21st, 3 days before the rescue helicopters and C-130s roared into Iran, Vance wrote the president, quote, "I know how deeply you have pondered your decision on Iran. I wish I could support you on it, but for the reasons we have discussed, I cannot." The details of Vance's reasons have not been made public. For example, was he opposed to this mission or any mission? What was the specific principle for which he resigned? State Department officials will only say the secretary was in total disagreement with the decision to go ahead. Officials also say the rescue mission was not the straw that broke the camel's back. There was no accumulation of issues that had Vance ready to resign, like personality clashes or that flap over the UN vote. Spokesman Hodding Carter, who says he has no plans to leave in the immediate future, said categorically today that until this dispute, Vance was planning to stay the full 4 years.
I am perfectly aware, as is everyone, of various stories that have run for 3 years about disagreements and the like, and repeated stories coming out of supposedly informed sources about his intention to quit because of disgust about this and that and the other. The fact of the matter is, as a fact and a certainty, he had no intention of resigning until this decision brought him to a place which he found he could not stay.
Spokesman Carter also denied reports suggesting Vance was automatically opposed to exercising any military options in Iran. But what seems clear today is this loyal man of the establishment was opposed to the increasing use of military threats against Iran, such as those made just yesterday by National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski.
I hope that it brings home to Tehran a very important message, which until a week ago, the Iranians were inclined to discount. And the message is this: do not scoff at American power, do not scoff at American reach. It is in Iran's interest to resolve this problem peacefully. It is our preference to resolve it peacefully.
Zbigniew Brzezinski on Face the Nation. A man who worked for the Secretary of State for 2 years, Leslie Gelb, former director of the Bureau of Politico and Military Affairs, explains Vance's opposition this way.
It's not that he couldn't countenance a military solution. I think it's that he felt a military solution would not work and would run counter to our political interests in the area. I'm sure Cyrus Vance, like everybody else, wanted to take a club and bat the Ayatollah in the head for what he did. What the Iranians are doing to the American hostage is absolutely inexcusable. But that doesn't mean that you stop using your good sense. And here was an administration sort of going in fits and starts toward the use of force in that country, doing the one thing that would ensure we would not be able to reestablish an American position in Iran, and doing the one thing that could justify some kind of Soviet intervention. This had to make no sense to Vance, and it had to have hit him in such a profound way that he began to contemplate departure.
Former State Department official Leslie Gelb. I'm Bill Buesenberg in Washington.
The last time a Secretary of State resigned in protest was in 1915, when William Jennings Bryan left the administration of President Woodrow Wilson. Ernest May, professor of history at Harvard University, says that Bryan was upset at the time by Wilson's policies toward the Germans.
It was over the position of the administration on German submarine warfare, in particular the Lusitania case. A German submarine had sunk the Lusitania with some America, British liner with some American passengers on board, and that was, in effect, a challenge to virtual ultimatum that the United States had given the Germans earlier. And the United States sent a very strong note of protest, which Bryan signed. Then the Germans responded with what was partly conciliatory and partly not conciliatory, and Wilson then decided to send a fairly stiff second note to them. And Bryan resigned rather than sign the second note. He felt that it was, in a sense, a last straw. Also, he felt had reason to feel increasingly that the president was not taking his advice, was taking advice from others. And so I think there may be that parallel.
Yes, that sounds like a parallel to the current circumstance, doesn't
and
it?
And it would be with absolutely no knowledge other than from the newspapers, I would guess that that's what it will look like when we can see the relevant papers, that we will not find it easy to see a very sharp issue over the operation in Iran or anything else that precipitated the resignation, but rather an increasing sense on the part of Secretary of State that his advice was not counting for what it should count for.
Professor May, if one looks at Cyrus Vance as a Secretary of State in a line of Secretaries of State, what do you suppose the judgment of history will be of him?
Well, he brought to the office quite formidable negotiating skills, and he obviously has made effective use of them. The accomplishments of the administration in foreign affairs have been primarily accomplishments of negotiation, the Panama Treaty, the Camp David Agreement. And my impression is that he contributed no little part to those successes just by being a very effective and accomplished negotiator.
Ernest May, professor of history at Harvard University.
All things considered, commentator Morton Kondracki says he isn't too upset about the news of Secretary Vance's departure, but the executive editor of the New Republic magazine is worried about the future direction of American foreign policy now that Vance is gone.
Contrary to what many columnists, professors, members of Congress, and allied leaders will be saying in the next few days, I don't think Cyrus Vance was a very good Secretary of State. He had his talents. A lawyer in civilian life, he apparently was a good negotiator. He was calm and unruffled. If you handed him a problem, he could break it down into its components, as a lawyer does with a brief, and try to get things ironed out amicably. But you expect more from a Secretary of State. You expect a worldview, a basic set of principles about where American policy should be heading and how we ought to get there. And you expect leadership, the ability to rally the country and Congress around your view. You may not have always liked their policies, but the strong secretaries of state since World War II, Acheson, Marshall, Dulles, and Kissinger, knew where they wanted to go and how to convince the country to follow. Vance tried to chop the world's problems up into individual national pieces and solve them one at a time. And still, we should all mourn his departure. For Cyrus Vance's real contribution to the nation was his opposition to the fireball policies of Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's shoot-first-and-ask-questions-later national security advisor. When Ethiopia and Somalia were fighting in the Horn of Africa, Brzezinski's big idea was to send a U.S. aircraft carrier into the region. To do what? Well, Brzezinski said we ought to just send it and see what happened. Brzezinski wanted the U.S. to stick with the Shah of Iran to the bitter end, to have U.S. policy, as he put it, go up in flames with the Shah. The most symbolic act of Brzezinski's tenure was to go to the Khyber Pass after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and pose for pictures pointing a machine gun in the direction of Soviet forces. When he was invited to actually fire the gun, he declined, but he told a Pakistani soldier to go ahead. The soldier lost control of the weapon, sprayed bullets all around, and knocked Brzezinski on the ground in the process. It was all big talk and posing, and when it came to actually doing something, it turned into a fiasco. Now that Cyrus Vance is gone, Brzezinski will be the dominant influence in American foreign policy. Some people compare this to Henry Kissinger's eclipsing of William Rogers during the Nixon administration, but there's a big difference. Henry Kissinger was an intellectual heavyweight, a deep strategic thinker. There's nobody like that in the Carter administration. Vance's departure will mean less inconsistency in American foreign policy. What we've got to fear, though, is that with Brzezinski in control, things will be consistently bad. For National Public Radio, this is Morton Kondracki in Washington.
President Carter will quickly name a replacement for Cyrus Vance. Four names keep cropping up. Lloyd Cutler, the president's legal counsel. He's handling the Olympic boycott these days. Ambassador Saul Linowitz, now in the Middle East for the Palestinian autonomy talks. Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor. And Warren Christopher, Vance's deputy. Christopher is now the acting Secretary of State. At the State Department, Baltimore Sun diplomatic correspondent Henry Truitt says that Warren Christopher has the best chance.
He is an extremely well-known Los Angeles lawyer, very active in California, held high offices in bar associations, civic leader, member of the Board of Trustees of Stanford University, a very active fellow, very well-known, but at the same time a quite shy and retiring man, if there's no paradox there. And he had very little experience in foreign policy, almost none in practical terms, when he came in, and I think this is important, as Mr. Vance's man.
Yes.
As Deputy Secretary of State.
Vance brought him in.
Vance brought him in. They were close personal friends, and Vance wanted someone he could trust and whom he knew quite well, and Mr. Christopher was it. He has performed, I must say, yeoman service. He's been a great behind-the-scenes operator, executing decisions that were made by others, making sure things got done, running the State Department, making it work when the Secretary was away. How he will do up front, I don't really know. Now, it's important to note, I think, in this regard, that not long ago, Mr. Brzezinski, who generally is regarded as being the victor in a power collision with the Secretary of State, also approves of Mr. Christopher, or at least he did as of two or three weeks ago when he told some people that Christopher was his man to succeed the secretary when he finally resigned. At that time, of course, the secretary was expecting to leave at the end
of
his term,
yes.
And if the president had been reelected.
Well, that's
then
an interesting observation, but you could also think that what Brzezinski might see in Christopher is a rubber stamp, someone who will carry out the Brzezinski idea of what foreign policy ought to be.
I think you're learning the Brzezinski system of foreign policy very quickly, Susan.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's exactly what Mr. Brzezinski had in mind.
Mm-hmm.
I have always been skeptical of what seems to be the accepted wisdom that Mr. Brzezinski does not want to be Secretary of State. He has said he does not, that he favors Mr. Christopher for the job. I always wonder about that because I rather think that Mr. Brzezinski would like to follow Henry Kissinger's mm-hmm. pattern, which was from the White House as National Security Advisor to the State Department, where he could really run foreign policy. But it may well be, and I rather suppose all the evidence points in this direction, that Mr. Brzezinski perhaps knows from talking with the president or from reading the tea leaves in the White House that he would not become Secretary of State. So therefore, it would be in his interest, given the nature of power struggles in Washington, to remain in the White House as National Security Advisors and to have a passive Secretary of State in the State Department.
In which case, the likelihood is that that secretary could be Warren Christopher.
And in that case, it almost certainly would be. I have to interject just one cautionary note in all this. In the last few weeks, I've gotten to know Mr. Christopher fairly well personally. I suspect, and I could not prove this at all, but I rather suspect there might be some surprises in store if he, in fact, held the title of Secretary of State and was called upon to exercise his judgment, because there is a great deal of steel beneath the surface. I rather think that Mr. Christopher, given the title and given the power and given the clout, might make his presence felt rather more than Mr. Brzezinski, for example, might expect.
Baltimore Sun diplomatic correspondent Henry Truitt at the State Department. President Carter broke his self-imposed White House isolation today. He flew to San Antonio, Texas, to visit the five American military men injured in last week's attempted rescue mission in Iran. The White House called this trip to Lackland Air Force Base a humanitarian gesture on the president's part. But the fact remains that on Saturday, Texans vote in Democratic caucuses. NPR's political correspondent Linda Wertheimer is in Texas, and I asked her what impact the president's trip might have.
I think that the president may get a bit of a backlash about it, and people will say that it's a political trip and so on. He's certainly tried to minimize that by not having any meetings or seeing anyone. I understand from the Democratic county chairman in the area where he is that the mayor tried to arrange to say hello or say goodbye or wave him in or out, and the White House was not receptive to the idea. However, I think it has to be said that President Carter will lead the national news with this humanitarian visit. He will be on all of Texas television stations, and Texas is such a big state that getting on all of Texas television stations is an expensive prospect if you're not doing it on free time. And he will be seen to be doing something presidential again, flying mm-hmm. off in Air Force One, landing at a military base, and in his role as commander-in-chief, visiting the fallen soldiers.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the president's challenger, Edward Kennedy, is in Texas today, too. Is that accidental? Had that been planned in advance?
The Kennedy schedule has been laid in for a while. He's coming to San Antonio and then to Houston, sticking with the big cities, partly because the senator has a strong pocket of support among Hispanic Americans in the state of Texas. It's one of his best and strongest groups.
But how much support does he need to pick up? How are they doing between them, Carter and Kennedy in Texas?
Carter is so far ahead in the state of Texas, according to a Texas Monthly poll, which was taken before the Pennsylvania primary and, of course, before the unsuccessful attempt to rescue the hostages in Iran. shows the president running better than 3-1 against Senator Kennedy. Huh. The president is dropping. He's dropped about 6 points. But when the drop is from the middle 70s to the high 60s, it's not a significant factor. Senator Kennedy is also gaining support. But again, it's so lopsided. I think what we'll have to see is just how Texas reacts to Iran, and the president's visit is obviously aimed at diffusing some of that.
Mm-hmm. And so if the senator were to have any hopes of coming out well in Texas, what would those hopes be based on?
I think the hopes would simply be based on a regional strategy, that where the liberal Democrats of Texas have a hold on the numbers of delegates in a precinct, and where the liberal Democrats come out in larger numbers to the caucuses, which are on the night of the primary day, Kennedy may be able to pick up delegates in the big city counties, and he may be able to get out of here with as much as 30% of Texas delegates. Of course, that's no way a win.
Yeah, thanks very much. NPR's national political correspondent Linda Wertheimer in Dallas.
The immediate reactions on Capitol Hill to the resignation of Secretary of State Vance were predictably strong and numerous. Members of the House of Representatives lined up at the microphones to get in their views, and senators trooped into the press gallery to have their say before the cameras. NPR's Kokiki Roberts reports.
Though most members of Congress like and respect Cyrus Vance, not all were sorry to see him go. Republican Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana serves on the Foreign Relations Committee.
I believe his resignation is appropriate. Very clearly, a Secretary of State who could not support a rescue mission for our hostages in Iran is simply inappropriate for these times. I suspect that even though Secretary Vance is a man of peace, obviously has not favored military action, has tried, in my judgment, to withdraw our forces substantially out of harm's way for the better part of 3 years. And the President of the United States changed his mind about the Soviet Union early this year. The President has changed his mind about a number of things. And he simply will need a new Secretary of State and, I think, a new foreign policy.
But Lugar was in the minority on Capitol Hill today. Even members who didn't particularly agree with Vance's policies thought he added an important balance to the Carter administration's foreign policy staff. Several members talked about having been frightened by National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski's television appearances over the weekend. Republican Congressman Jim Leach of Iowa is a former Foreign Service officer.
Vance's departure symbolizes not only dissent with the administration's foreign policy, but discomfort with the entire national security decision-making process, one which elevates Ham Jordan to ambassador and Zbigniew Brzezinski to an unaccountable combination of Secretary of State and Defense. What is needed is consistency in foreign policy execution. The abortive rescue operation and departure of the most respected member of the cabinet leaves all Americans apprehensive about what to expect next from the John Wayne School of Diplomacy.
The idea of the John Wayne School of Diplomacy scares even those members who have helped promote quick draw policies in the past, and they are calling on the president to find a person of national stature from outside the administration to replace Vance. Washington Democrat Henry Jackson serves on the Senate Armed Services Committee.
I'm saying that it should be someone that will restore confidence in this country. This is an election year, but more important than anything else is the ability of this country to speak effectively and forcefully in the cause of peace and to prevent the danger of irrational conduct at a time of tension and at a time when the world is looking to this country for leadership.
While members of Congress talked publicly about finding a Secretary of State who would calm the Allies, they talked privately about finding someone who would placate their constituents. Some Democrats worry that this incident might send the president as low in the polls as his mass firings of cabinet members did last summer. That could mean trouble for them in their own campaigns. A few Democrats have decided to go beyond looking at possibilities for a new Secretary of State to look at what alternatives might still exist as at this late date for a new Democratic nominee. Younger members in trouble back home are taking another look at party rules and seeing if it's possible to catapult a known national figure like Maine Senator Edmund Muskie or Arizona Congressman Morris Udall into the nomination process. But the accumulation of delegates the president now has and the filing deadlines for most state ballots make that scenario pretty unlikely. I'm Cokie Roberts in Washington.
Political experts saw the Vance resignation as a clear sign of more trouble for the president. NPR's Nina Totenberg spent the day sampling opinion inside and outside the administration.
Sandy, even the Carter people know that the Vance resignation could hurt the president badly. As one Carter advisor told me today, the pie is getting smaller. The land we can stand on is shrinking. This advisor said that he figured originally that Carter might not be hurt by the failed rescue mission, but the Vance resignation and others that are bound to follow in the next few weeks make it seem that things are out of control again. And this source added that Carter will also be hurt by the inevitable debate on the planning and execution of the mission. Why were there only 8 helicopters instead of 10? Why didn't they go ahead with 5, etc.? This Carter man thought that the rescue mission itself was a catharsis, but the Vance resignation makes it look, as he put it, like the administration is crumbling.
Nina, how do other political experts outside the Carter administration view the situation?
Well, to varying degrees, I heard the same thing all day as I phoned around to Democratic and Republican pollsters and campaign experts. In the short run, the president may not have suffered from the rescue mission, but in the long run, they said, it's a disaster. One pollster noted that the cover of Newsweek says fiasco, the cover of Time says disaster, and that will start sinking in on the American consciousness. One Republican pollster noted that the American people almost always support a president in the midst of an international crisis. The 4 exceptions to that were President Eisenhower during the U-2 crisis, President Johnson during the Tet Offensive and when the Pueblo was seized, and Nixon during the invasion of Cambodia. This pollster thought that the rescue mission could turn out to be the 5th such example. He said the Vance resignation gives credibility to Carter's, quote, extreme recklessness in dealing with the Allies. He said it accelerates the general dissatisfaction with the planning and execution of the mission, and it goes to the heart of Carter's big weakness, the public perception of him as a bungler. Or, as another pollster put it, normally the resignation of a Secretary of State wouldn't matter to most people, but it adds to the subconscious perception that the wheels are coming off the Carter wagon. One Democratic campaign expert argued today that Carter has trapped himself, that he could have removed the Iran story from the front pages months ago by ignoring it somewhat in public the way President Johnson did with the Pueblo and by going quietly about the business of dealing with the Iranians. But the president chose to keep the story on page 1, this Democratic campaign expert said. And now the president is trapped there. In fact, the dilemma Carter faces was illustrated today in a bit of behind-the-scenes maneuvering over one of his campaign films. Carter, you may remember, had a half-hour documentary that played widely earlier this year. It leaned heavily on his accomplishments in foreign affairs, particularly Camp David. And it contained a section in which Carter lavishly praised Secretary of State Vance. Well, today, when NPR tried to get the soundtrack of the film for use on this broadcast, this open administration suddenly clammed up and wouldn't allow the film to be used. In other words, the same film that the Carter people paid to have broadcast was under lock and key today.
Nina, what about this trip the president was making today to visit the injured soldiers who've now been flown to an army hospital in Texas?
Again, Democratic and Republican campaign strategists, and I stress that this includes some Carter people, think the visit is a mistake. Carter's strength is in the public view of him as a generally unpolitical, honest man of integrity who's trying to do his best. But as one Republican pollster put it today, in going to Texas, Carter's pushing a very thin line. Once he goes over that line, his image could crack like crystal, this man said.
Nina, getting back to the Vance resignation, Secretary Vance was often viewed as the link of the Carter administration to a sort of unofficial foreign policy establishment. He was a New York lawyer. He had good ties with those people in the business community. If that link is gone now, what's the effect of it?
Well, all that you've said is true. We've all seen the Averill Harrimans and the Clark Cliffords, the George Balls, acting as advisors to presidents. And it was really when these men became angry and concerned about the war in Vietnam, that the opposition to the war got real clout. Today, I called a man who's been in this establishment for years, a man who's been a cabinet secretary and an advisor to many presidents over the last 35 years or so. When I asked him what the role of this knowledgeable establishment would be now that Cy Vance is gone, he said, well, it's different now anyway. They never call us, those Carter people.
Thanks very much, NPR's Nina Totenberg.
President Carter has been on a political seesaw for months now. When his critics aren't attacking his foreign policy, they're attacking his economic policy. Right now, the focus is foreign, but we haven't forgotten economics, and neither, apparently, has Ronald Reagan. NPR's economics correspondent Robert Krulwich prepared this report.
When Ronald Reagan talks about economics, he spends some time, of course, talking about his tax cut plan, but he almost always moves right on to what he feels is one of his most attractive qualities, that unlike Jimmy Carter, he sees a bright and comfortable future for this country, while the president, he says, offers a vision that is cramped and uncomfortable and suggests that we are somehow to blame.
Always when he comes before us, he makes us believe that inflation is somehow our fault, that we're buying too many things, we're living too high off the hog, that this is the reason for inflation.
And Reagan says he finds the same scolding tone in the president's energy program, a program designed, he suggests, by someone who likes to make other people uncomfortable.
Turn the thermostats up if it's too hot, turn them down if it's too cold. Anyway, be uncomfortable. Don't drive your cars or drive them less. The only thing that's been suggested is conservation and higher taxes and prices on what we have. That's not the answer, and we're not to blame.
This theme that the president has gotten too preachy and too vindictive, that Americans are somehow unjustly being accused, is now a standard part of the Reagan stump speech.
I think Governor Reagan is right.
That is Michael Novak, a Reagan supporter, a writer and theologian. He says that President Carter has handed Governor Reagan an opportunity and the governor is simply running with it. Carter says Novak has always reminded voters of a preacher, but the image has changed in the last year or so. The president has relaxed his theme of preaching the goodness of the American people, an approach that had great appeal. Now Novak sees a different kind of preacher creeping in.
The sort of preacher who tries to make people feel small, petty, mean. The American psyche is a psyche built around possibility, but he's begun to call us to reform out of feelings of guilt. And that doesn't wash very well with the American people.
Too many of us now tend to worship self-indulgence and consumption.
Reagan senses that the president's tone, never mind whether the president is right or wrong, the tone itself is an issue, or certainly Reagan is determined to make it an issue. He suggests to his audience that economic policy is to a great degree a reflection of a president's personality, and that Carter's personality is too defensive and too vindictive, inappropriate for someone who wants to lead a country. A leader, he says, ought to be more hopeful and more positive than Jimmy Carter.
But we've discovered that owning things and consuming things does not satisfy.
I don't think that you really can talk people out of buying things that make life more comfortable.
There is another subtext to this critique of President Carter. The man you just heard, Ernest Dichter, is by trade a futurist. He writes books about what will happen to us in the next 20 to 50 years. While he says, a lifelong Democrat, he finds it odd for a candidate from the Democratic Party to be preaching in an election year that people should try to lower their appetites, that it would somehow be better if we didn't want so many things for ourselves. Carter, says Dichter, is questioning here a notion of progress that is very basic to American society, that people work to better themselves, that bettering oneself often means acquiring things. When a president starts to question the validity of acquiring things, he is testing, says Dichter, a very basic American motivation.
We work because we're motivated, and we're motivated because we can fulfill some of our dreams.
Dreams.
And you're starting a vicious cycle if you tell people, stop wishing. I should be able to acquire luxuries.
Is that what you think that President Carter's subliminal message is when he says we have to conserve?
Well, maybe, yeah.
What is he supposed to do? Suppose he believes this. Is he supposed to sweep it under the rug?
Alan Ferguson is a liberal, actually a very liberal economist. Normally, he does not defend President Carter, but on this question of growth and what the real prospects for growth are, he thinks that Carter is telling people the truth, while Reagan, who promises that he can fix problems by giving industry a free hand and by thinking positively, that, says Ferguson, is just wishful thinking.
There is no reason to think that we can continue our rise in individual material standard of living in the future as we have in the past. And I think Carter is entirely right to tell people that there are values that transcend the value of consumption and having and using things.
Nevertheless, Ferguson admits that the president is not a very good salesman for this point of view. When Carter talks about his economic programs, it seems to Ferguson that it's a lot gloomier than it ought to be.
He's just not getting across the fact that there is a great deal that can be done.
But until Carter can deliver that nice and more positive vision, the president, says Michael Novak, will remain vulnerable.
And that's leaving the tracks wide open for Governor Reagan.
I'm Robert Krulwich in Washington.